Mark Furman has over 40 years of experience litigating complex civil cases. He represents businesses, business owners, institutions, and families. Mark was named a U.S. News Best Lawyer for Commercial Litigation from 2022 to 2025. He was a U.S. News Best Lawyer for Litigation, Trusts, and Estates from 2020 to 2025, and a Massachusetts Super Lawyer by Thomson Reuters from 2004 to 2024. Mark was selected for inclusion in Best Lawyers in America for Litigation, Trusts, and Estates. He's a partner at the law firm Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers. Mark is chair of the firm's litigation department, and he serves on its management committee. Mark receives his JD from Boston College Law School as a member of the bars of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
Great to be here. I have to say the market basket case is one of my favorite family dispute stories. And I would like to just give a little bit of an overview of the history of the dispute, which really goes back a very long time, but had an interesting ending to it 10 years ago. So a little bit about the company. The first Arthur and his wife, who I think is her name was Ephrosine, Demoulas started a neighborhood grocery store in 1917 in Lowell, and two of their six children ended up buying the business from them, George and Telemachus. And they, over a 10-year period from 54 to 64, added 10 additional stores. And they then formed Demoulas Supermarkets, which was owned by George and his wife, and Telemachus and his wife. And by 1970, it was a chain of 14 supermarkets plus nine stores that I guess were a little smaller. They each had four children, and George died at a early age in 1971, at which time Telemachus assumed control. And there was a historical voting trust agreement so that Telemachus could vote all the shares. So everything was fine until 1971, but then the company grew, but Demoulas Supermarkets didn't benefit from it because it was owned half by the George side and half by the Telemachus side. So other entities were created, other stores were built. There was a drugstore company, real estate companies, and Telemachus's family controlled those, although the Demoulas supermarket personnel did work in some of those businesses. So many years later, actually 1990, George's widow and her children sued the other side of the family, claiming that they had usurped corporate opportunities that belonged to Demoulas Supermarkets. And the net result was that most of the vast majority of the combined wealth was owned by the Telemachus side. So suit was filed. It took about 7 years for judgment. It's an 84-day trial. It's a famous trial for a variety of reasons, but it was found that that there had been a breach of fiduciary duty, and the court ordered the return of all of the properties so that it was under one umbrella. By that time, Arthur T, let's call him Artie, was his nickname, was running Market Basket. And the lead person on the other side was his cousin, Arthur S. So we'll call him Arthur S, and we'll talk about Artie. So although there was this gigantic court judgment, Artie remained in operational control, and there were hard feelings among the different branches of the company. Artie ran the company in a interesting way, very generous in terms of profit sharing contributions, making sure that Market Basket was priced comfortably below basically every other supermarket chain. And so the impact was loyal employees, loyal customers, but not that much money being distributed to the the family members who didn't operate the company as they liked. So although the original lawsuit, actually is more than one, ended, the hostility between the sides of the family continued and continued and never abated. In 2007, the Market Basket profit sharing plan invested in $12.5 million and Freddie Mac right before the financial crisis. And there were some other activities. Once the financial crisis hit, things didn't work out with some of the investments in the profit sharing plan. Meanwhile, the Arthur S. side of the family was in litigation seeking a court order to force mandatory distributions, which Artie opposed, but the Massachusetts Superior Court allowed to go forward, a $300 million distribution in 2013. And rumors started flying that Arthur S. was going to obtain control of the board, and the ultimate intention was to fire Artie. And so so the board of directors began a new selection process to find a new investment advisor for the profit sharing plan, the profit sharing plan having lost some money. Trustees were removed, and a couple of folks who were trustees were fired. They also worked in the company. And then in June of 2014, with the with one director changing whose side they were on, they voted Artie out of the company. He was terminated. And that set off one of the more interesting reactions I've ever seen, if not the most interesting, to the termination of a CEO who was running a company. Within a couple of days, seven executives quit their jobs to protest Artie's firing. Employees at the Burlington Market Basket started handing out flyers. We need your help to customers. We need your help to bring Artie back. So the employees started engaging in concerted action to begin a pressure campaign using customers to bring Artie back. And they were encouraging boycotting the stores. And the customers actually did boycott the stores. So you have this employee revolt. You have a customer revolt. It's a little hard to sell a product without customers and employees. And Artie announces that he's prepared to buy out the other side of the family. So this fight is all over the press. And everybody's got a PR firm and lawyers and is looking at the stakeholders or interested parties who can help carry the day for their side. But Arthur S. is I would say the PR was clearly favorable to Artie. The newspaper reports were favorable to Artie. The idea that Artie, while in control, may have been withholding distributions from owners in order to keep the business running as though he was the sole owner or his side of the family was. So later in July, new CEOs were named to replace Artie, who told the employees that they had to come back or they were going to be fired. In response to that, they didn't come back, the employees were terminated, and they publicly announced that they were going to sue Market Basket for wrongful termination because they were exercising their First Amendment rights to speak out, and they were exercising their right to collective concerted action under labor laws. Right after that, Artie issues a statement, press release, that he's ready to go back to work in the company in advance of completing a stock purchase agreement with the other side of the family. And that he would bring back with him during this interim period that they would be negotiating the stock purchase agreement, all the employees. Market Basket, meanwhile, is trying to hire people, but there are picket lines that are making it unusual to hire people to work in the stores. So they ended up holding they wanted to hold a job fair, but they ended up having to do it through email because of what was going on with the employees. So, so it was only, it was so public that it was only a matter of time that the politicians were going to get involved. A rally gets held in Tewkesbury. So this is like the fourth rally in a very short period of time. And Martha Coakley, who's the attorney general at the time, creates a hotline for Market Basket employees to call so that they can learn about their legal rights. The board of directors, in the next day that Martha Coakley announces the hotline, the board of directors invites Artie to rejoin the company, but not as the CEO. And Artie declines the offer. That same day, Governor Deval Patrick pens a letter to the Market Basket Board of Directors urging them to find a prompt resolution. And his public statement says to them, "Your failure to resolve this matter is not only hurting the company's brand and business, but also many innocent and relatively powerless workers whose livelihoods depend on you." The next day, following Governor Patrick's letter, a letter gets sent to the, Arthur S. issues a statement that he's willing to sell to Artie and provide a loan on some basis for the payout of the purchase price. But he also says that Artie's conduct is undermining, undermining Market Basket. Artie, of course, issues his counterstatement that he does not believe a war of press releases and statements is helpful, and that this is a very serious situation, and he doesn't want to negotiate in the press. And so there were a few independent directors on the board. They asked the employees to come back again. "It's time to come back," they said, "and act in the best interests of the company, the employees, the customers." And Governor Patrick, who's now very involved, no pressure, on the 14th of August, just a couple of days later, announces he has spoken to both the board of directors and Artie, and a deal is in the works. And he calls on the Market Basket workers to go back to work. And indeed, a deal is struck. Artie T. Side of the family buys out the other side. He becomes the owner again, receives a hero's welcome from the employees. And I just find it so fascinating the way that the employees had such loyalty to Artie. The customers had such loyalties. There are stories about empty shelves in the Market Basket stores. The customers weren't coming. The employees were fighting for him. In the meantime, there is another side of the story, which is, you know, I think the company grew and grew, got more and more successful. There was plenty of money. And it seems like perhaps more could have been distributed to the owners. But, you know, that historical fight, I think, lingered. And I've wondered, if Market Basket was unionized, would this have ever happened? a, you know, there, if there was a collective bargaining agreement, I'm not a labor lawyer, but if there was a collective bargaining agreement, it's, you know, it'd certainly say no strike during the term of the agreement. The CEO gets fired. I wonder what would happen. Here you have, in a non-union setting, the power of the employees and the customers drove the sale of the company. And to Artie's side of the family, and Artie ended up back in control. So I find it a really interesting case.
How is Market Basket doing? How did Market Basket do after this event?
I think it's doing fabulous. You know, he's got a formula that is somewhat unique. I'm not a shopper there. But everyone who I've ever talked with who shops there say their prices are cheaper than every other supermarket. So you know, so I think their market is value shoppers, and they're all over Northeast Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and I'm not sure how many stores they have, but it's the 10th anniversary of this really dramatic ending to a many decade long fight among the families.
In the 10 years since Market Basket, have there been any other leaders in anyone's recollection kind of like Artie and be able to get workers and customers?
You know, Larry, the only other business family business case I recall with such a beloved leader was the Malden Mills gentleman, where the factory burnt down and he continued to support his employees. You know, a much different, you know, it wasn't an internal squabble, but a private company, family owned CEO who stood up and made his employees first.
Yeah, Aaron Fairstein did great.
Right. I forgot about that case.
Well, Larry, I was around at that time and a customer.
Me
And
too.
I thought it was the most extraordinary thing I had ever seen. The first thing, that place has not only lower prices, but it has better stuff. In other words, they don't have the most expensive stuff. Like, you can't get Häagen-Dazs ice cream there.
Yes, you can.
Well,
Oh,
what? Boy, I haven't noticed it. I'll have to check again. I go
if
in a week.
John says you can, believe him.
Okay, well, where is it? Is it along that side wall? Oh, actually, I go in Waltham. I don't know if you go in Waltham.
There's a whole section of premium ice cream it's with.
But so Mark, as you describe this to us, and Larry, I don't know where the discussion's going in terms of what you want us to do, but you spoke actually very little about the actual actions and steps and role that the board played during all this litigation. Were they as divided with was the board divided along RDT and RDS lines, or?
They were, but already controlled the board by one vote. And then that member switched sides. You know, some might argue, and I think I remember reading in one of the national magazines, business magazines, about the case. Artie was arguably trying to squeeze the other side out. You know, they hadn't been successful in what happened between 1971 and 1990. But he, as he continued to, this is the anti-Artie view, but as he continued to run the company, that, and he had control of the board, that he was, not making it easy for the other side. Mm-hmm. And so when the votes switched, he was no longer in control of the board. And the argument in favor of Arthur S.'s position and his side of the family, I mean, this is a for-profit company. It is should be run for the benefit of the shareholders, and that trying to maximize profits is not a bad thing to do. And yes, you need customers and you need customer loyalty, and it's great to have employee loyalty, but I think they had a very different view of the balance and how much of Artie's approach was intended as payback, and how much was just because he was so devoted to his employees. And but there was, there were so many lawsuits, we could spend hours just talking about the lawsuits, which is why I took the approach that I did.
Mark, if I recall correctly, the board member who switched sides was Arthur T's daughter, who had supported her uncle until they got to this point, and then she switched. So there's a whole family intrigue thing on top of everything else.
If you could go back in time, a long, long time, what advice would you give to the original mom who set up that whole complicated setup?
Well, it's hard because when the classic is mother and dad start a business. Okay, so they had six children, two wanted the business. So there was the first generational transfer was easy, but nobody expected George to die when he did. And so when two people who are dominating the company, basically controlling all the shares, and it's 50-50, and one unexpectedly dies and they're both working in the business, now you got a problem because, on the one hand, people generally don't want the spouses or family of the deceased shareholder to be owners. You want to have frequently, I think, an agreed buyout in the event of death. And so on the other hand, I think there's probably this trust factor, that brothers will take care of each other in the event one of them dies. I know that I see you shaking your head, and we all know from experience that human nature isn't always like that. So I think that was a mistake, putting control in one side of the family. The temptation is too great. And, they had a great business and a great brand. And, people start to feel like, wait a minute. I mean, it's one thing when George was here, but he's not here now. We're doing all the stuff and we're making all the decisions and we deserve more. So I think it was something like they ended up with, before the court decision, I think in 97, I think it might have been like 92% of the value was on one side of the family. So, you know, usually I seek buyouts in the event of death funded by insurance, and if insurance isn't available on some other basis, not always. Sometimes they're mandatory. Sometimes it's an option. But the court decisions didn't dig into, at least the ones that I read and preparing for today, they didn't dig into the original shareholder agreement between George and Telemachus, if in fact they even updated, they had one, you know, because of the way sometimes businesses were run.
Mark, were there any external board members in this situation at all?
Yeah, there were a couple. There were a couple independent board members.
Hey, Mark, do you think it would have been different? Because it was a 7-member board, right? You had 4 family members. You had Raphael Evans, who switched over. So it would have been different if it had been 4 independents and 3 family members?
Might have been. It'd be hard to get a family to agree to that, but but in that hypothetical, which I don't think I've ever seen, yeah, it could have been a different. I don't know. The it's I don't know. Just you know, I one of the biggest problems that I see is people don't update their operating agreements and shareholder agreements for years and years, and sometimes decades and decades, and they're totally outdated. And you know, I just settled one where the you know, it was a nice business, but it said if somebody retires, they get the they should agree on a value annually, and if somebody retires or then they get that the most recent value if there hasn't been one agreed upon in the past year. So it turned out that they hadn't updated the value for 20 years. The company today bore no relationship to the company back then, so that led to a dispute. But people, you know, they do the same thing with their estate planning documents. They do them, and then 20 years later, they may look at them again, and all sorts of life changes have occurred. So, I mean, I don't know how often they did this. But, you know, one thing I see in my practice is greed is a common human trait. And for many people, anything less than 100% is not enough. So you need to have clear agreements. So, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar company now, I think. It's one of the biggest regional chains. There is a lot of consolidation in that industry now. I see Roach Brothers, I think, is being sold. So I don't know what the lesson is.
My perspective is that if you are a non-family member of a board of directors, you should be in the forefront of making sure that there are succession plans and transfer of ownership plans ahead of the death of the founder or the CEO. I'm thinking about a case I was involved in. It was an insurance brokerage, and there was father and 2 brothers. And the reason that they cooperated with each other was because dad was there. But the reality was the oldest son was very much like the father and was aggressive and growth-oriented and very salesy. And the youngest brother was very much like his mother, who risk averse and always looking to be conservative. And I was brought in to look at leadership succession. And I said that if dad dies, the two brothers will simply either go after each other, and you can't have a governance with two people who can't agree on the time of day, or they'll set up a Chinese wall in between them, so they would have to work with each other, and that will really harm the business. And what I recommended, what they did, was the oldest son got 100% shares of the business upon the death of father, and the youngest son got key man life insurance policy on dad, so that he got a whole bunch of money that he could start his own companies in another industry, which is what he did. But I think as board members, I think our greatest value is to really focus on what happens after the founder's death. Mm-hmm. And John, yeah, he was really talking about that as well. And when he was talking about his case, because the whole setup was really done before the founder died.
Yeah, most of the cases I've been involved in, there is an operating agreement, or there is a shareholder agreement, but it's put in a draw, and there's no checkup about it. Mm-hmm. And circumstances change. People's contributions change, people's health changes, all sorts of things change. And so it needs to be regularly looked at and updated. But just a corporate housekeeping matter.
Larry Schiff, the rumor is you've been involved with a couple of family businesses.
Yeah.
over the years. That's just a rumor.
I sure have hundreds of them.
Yeah,
I've seen anything and everything you can ever imagine, both sitting on some of these family boards and also advising them. By the way, I knew all the independent directors in Demoulas too, so I knew that situation pretty well.
What's your takeaway from the Demoulas case?
I was just in shock what went on in the whole thing, to be honest, because there were other opportunities earlier. I don't know how much I can say, but there were other opportunities earlier where certain family members could have been bought out and they decided not to. So, and nobody really talks about that. And just in terms of just seeing, because it reminded me, I thought that was a great point, Ken. It reminded me of Aaron Fierstein, like to see the employees get behind like that. That was pretty amazing. I mean, for a family business, and it just seemed like the whole thing was was going to lean towards RDS when that whole thing happened. I mean, that was the game changer, what you were talking about, Mark, that you had both employees and the vendors, by the way. So right, we were with a bunch of the vendors, and the vendors are like, we're not shipping, we're holding
right,
everything.
Right.
I'm like, what? We're literally stopping shipping that. So that was, it wasn't just the employees and the, I mean, there were a lot of pieces going on. That's why the shelves were empty. They were holding off. So I thought it was fascinating, but no, I've dealt with who let the crazies out. I mean, I've been in board meetings where they had fired a family member and he came into the board meeting armed.
Wow.
And I was advising, sitting in the board. It was at a hotel. And one of the board members said, are you caring? And he said, yes. And he said, excuse me. And one of the board members left the room and went and got hotel security and the police. So that was pretty frightening, because we weren't sure if he was just going to start shooting or what. So I've seen some. And then I've been involved in a lot of different lawsuits where, I mean, that's sort of the bad part of it. No offense, Mark, you probably maybe like that part, but how much money gets spent on each side? I mean, some of that has ended up in the destruction of businesses when you're talking about, you know, each side spending. I dealt with a company, each side end up spending, and I was the one saying, let's settle immediately. They didn't want to settle, and each side end up spending, you know, between 15 and 18 million, and the company eventually went under over it. So that's sort of like the worst part, I think, in some of these family lawsuits.
It does happen.
Do you think the courts ruled correctly at these different stages? Like, was the Artie side of the family basically correct in that their legitimate economic interests were being stolen, and were the courts which didn't slap down later on when Artie did these efforts, were they right to not slap down as well? I may be using the wrong phrasing.
Yeah. Well, the original decision is one of the things that's controversial about it is who the judge was. Maria Lopez, who became ultimately a TV judge. There were claims that she was biased against the Telemachus side of the family. And there were motions to disqualify her from sitting on the case. And then a few lawyers got a little carried away. I don't know if anybody remembers reading about this, but they ran a sting operation and lost their law licenses. What they did was Maria Lopez's clerk was looking for a job. So they arranged an interview, I think in, I forget where, New York or something, for this high-powered job. And they started inquiring about things that Maria Lopez had said, because he was the clerk on the case. That you don't do. Okay, it's like, so one of those lawyers, you know, Artie was loyal to his customers, he's loyal to employees, and he ended up hiring this lawyer, lost his license, who was one of the lawyers who represented the defense in the case in the 90s. So I've never seen a case where the lawyers decided to investigate the judge to try to get evidence. And, you know, to say this was a hotly contested case. And, you know, the thing with trials is, you know, there are what the judge finds as facts, which are basically not reviewable, versus what the judge says the law is, which is reviewable without any discretion. So when Judge Lopez says that, you know, there was an evil intent to personally benefit at the expense of the George side of the family, that's not one of those things that an appellate court is going to flip. So, I mean, you do have, it's an important case that, you know, as a lawyer in terms of the fiduciary duties that in Massachusetts entities, which are pretty, the fiduciary duties are pretty powerful, where shareholders owe fiduciary duties to each other. Of course, the board has fiduciary duties. But in closely held corporations, in the absence of a operating agreement or shareholder agreement that explicitly disclaims fiduciary duties, they exist. And, you know, fiduciary duties is the highest duties in the law, the duties that trustees owed to beneficiaries, lawyers owed to clients. You can't put your personal interests ahead of the interests of the people to whom you owe fiduciary duties. So it's a pretty tough standard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know what would have. So it's good practice point is to disclaim them unless you want them in there in a if you have a Massachusetts entity. I recognize many entities are incorporated in other states, and Massachusetts courts will usually accept state of incorporation as a very important factor in what law applies. Excuse me, I have a little cough. So.
I would love to understand more about the board member who switched roles. Do you have any insights to share whether what reason the daughter had in supporting her uncle in the first place, what made her switch, and how critical was that switch post facto?
The switch led to Artie's termination. I forget the motivation, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Mark, for your review of this. And what I'd like to do is now break you up into groups of three, four each. And we have between now and 6:30, discuss the case in terms of your perspective. What's it like to be on a board of a family business? How do you avoid these kinds of issues? But also use the time to get to know each other and then to wish each other a very happy Thanksgiving. And I want to wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving. We will see you all on January. So we have wisely decided not to compete with Santa Claus in December. So we'll see you in January. Mark, thank you very much for this discussion. Again, please start your breakout rooms by talking about what the case might mean for you, and then get to know each other and stay as long as you want.
Hey Mark, by the way, Mark, say hello to my dear friend Jeff Hart for me, please.
I will.
All right, I'm going to break you off now.
Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure.